To commence these proceedings with an announcement is somewhat like delaying the Gettysburg Address with a commercial. But being your quarterly chairman, I want to announce that next Friday we will have His Excellency Vasco Vieira Guerin here to speak to us, and I had some help from our speaker today on how to pronounce that. They're good friends. He will talk to us on Portuguese and talk to us on Portugal, Africa, and Asia. Now, if you don't know Barry Goldwater, you're not much of an historian, you can't be an American, and you most certainly did not vote in the last presidential election. Without further ado, and on behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California, I take great pride and pleasure in introducing one of the great citizens of our time, Senator Barry Goldwater of the United States of America.
Chairman, my old and valued friend Bill Nolan from across the bay, ladies and gentlemen, you have no idea what an honor this is. This is the third time I've been with this wonderful club, and to be able to survive two of my speeches is something in itself, but to ask for a third one takes a lot of courage, and I'm very, very happy to be here. In fact, I'm always happy to return to San Francisco. I call it the Goldwaters' ancestral home in the United States. I think there are more Goldwaters buried up here than are buried in Arizona. And I'm up here with my family this weekend for the happy occasion of attending our youngest son's wedding tomorrow over in Ross. Now, if I can just get the oldest son to begin to see some of the advantage of being married, we'll have completed everything. But speaking of marriages, of course, you know there's one coming up in Washington now, and it's easy to tell the Republicans in Washington, because when they talk about a wedding, they say, whose? And it's always easy back there now to tell an optimist. He's a Republican dove who's opposed to the tax increase but is awaiting his invitation to the wedding. And ladies and gentlemen, as an American who feels that America must, and I repeat, must, as it always has in the past, stand behind their president in a period of war, I want to congratulate the citizens of this city who turned down a proposal just a few weeks ago which would have said, in effect, Mr. President, we do not go with you, and you would have said to the world that this great and important city had forgotten the courageous place it has always held in the hearts of people everywhere. And today, in this city, which has always turned its eyes to the world and never to the wall, I want to speak with you just briefly about one of the most dangerous words in the political vocabulary, and that word is isolationism. It is a dangerous word because it is a word that promises but cannot perform, a word that hides the death of vision and vigor behind a mask of plain wishful thinking. And if I happen to step on some toes today, those toes are not as important to me as the entire body of our nation, which, if it ever again becomes infected with the virus of isolationism, will sicken and die. America is part of the world. We, you and I, are part of the world. And we can't withdraw from the fact, or from the future, or from the responsibilities that this implies. In fact, whether you and I like it or not, we came out of World War II, the world's leader in business, and the world's leader in military power, which makes us the world's leader. And I must remind you that there is no Maginot line long enough or high enough to hide us from the world. There's no ocean broad or deep enough to shelter us from the winds of the world. And we must, as other nations have done before us, when they have worn the mantle of leadership, lead the world toward the goals of peace and freedom and away from the dark goals of slavery and war. And ladies and gentlemen, let me remind you, should there be blindness deep enough to hide from us the fact that this nation is the great example of and the great hope of freedom, not only behind our shores, but across every shore on earth, what bushel of isolationism could hide such a light? Now, it wasn't, of course, always so. In the time of our beginning, it was right and proper, I think, for George Washington to speak of attending to affairs at home first, to keeping our hedges high, as I remember his farewell speech. Building the nation was the job at that time. The affairs of Europe were quite literally and correctly foreign affairs. But today, there are no foreign affairs. Neither a sparrow nor a government can fall anywhere on this earth without seismic traces in our own affairs. We are linked today by over 40 treaties to the defense of that many nations. War in their areas is instant war, and we must face that fact, or we abandon the treaties. Now, having emerged as the world leader from World War II, it was very proper that under Presidents Truman and Eisenhower, a basis for our foreign policy was built upon our economic and our military strength. Now, as a reaffirmation of this basic policy, the Senate advised and consented to over 40 treaties with other countries now called mutual security pacts, and these call in very specific language for the defense of these countries when defense is required. In view of this, I have suggested, in light of what we've learned about the difficulties of war in Vietnam, that the Senate of the United States re-examine those treaties, not with a specific view of withdrawing our support, for that would be impossible, but so that the American people, through discussion on the Senate floor, might know better the pledges that have been made to other countries. And I go back a bit to my own campaign a few years ago, that cliffhanger you might recall. I was trying to engage President Johnson in discussion about a war that was going on at that time in Vietnam, and he refused to discuss. And I think it will prove to be one of his costliest mistakes, because the American people found out, not through discussion, but through the actual facts, that we were at war, and the American people were shocked, and they have not gotten over that shock yet. Now, what most of the people who are calling for an immediate withdrawal from Vietnam without regard for victory or honor seem to overlook is that we do have an obligation to that same honor in these same 40-odd treaties. The only alternative that I sense in their proposals is the alternative of isolationism plus a dishonor. Now, I want to be charitable to these people, because some of them are Republicans and some of them are Democrats. I don't think they have really thought through the broad, dangerous implications of what they are suggesting without offering any alternatives other than the alternative that America try to live in this busy world all by itself. When we are linked by commerce to most of the nations on earth, and trade, which should be the most non-ideological of pursuits, has become a sharp, cutting weapon of ideology. We are linked by needs to supplier nations. We are linked by productive surpluses with consumer nations. We are linked by research to laboratories everywhere. We are linked by culture to theaters, galleries, libraries, and halls across the oceans and around the earth. And in the face of all this, however, we continue to hear the most persistent and highly placed calls for American isolationism that we've heard since the days of America First, and the calls of those who felt that the aggressions of Adolf Hitler were of as little concern then as some say the aggressions of Ho Chi Minh are today. Now, all of those who call for isolationism and dishonor have made a common cause around a common complaint. America, they say, must withdraw its interest in the world and substitute for it an obsessive interest only in itself. And let me, as a Republican now, bring back a little history. It was a Republican Secretary of State, Mr. Seward, who just 100 years ago, in 1867, operating in conjunction with a Republican president, saw the importance of the Pacific to the defense of our own country. Now, it's long been axiomatic that when a country reaches its natural boundaries, in order to keep its own soil from being torn with war, outside perimeters should be sought. Unfortunately for us, those perimeters on the East Coast have in two instances been extended to the soil of Europe. But in 1867, when the western boundary of our continent had been reached, it was obvious to Mr. Seward that any war coming from the Pacific would have to be fought from the shores of California, Oregon, and Washington. And realizing this, he started negotiations for the acquisition of Alaska, Hawaii, and the Midway Islands. And while all of these lands were not immediately acquired, nevertheless, they were acquired, and in every administration since that time, I repeat, every administration, Republican and Democrat, the interest of the Pacific has been paramount in the interest of American foreign policy. And I'll remind you that this interest has grown to be more than that of having perimeter lands to protect our shores. It's a realization that the great areas of future economic expansion in this world are now confined to Latin America and to the great and growing economies of the Far East. Japan is an example, Taiwan another, Korea, Thailand, and we see increased economic activity all over the land areas of the far Pacific. Now, does the isolationist now suggest that the United States retreat from its historic position of interest in the Pacific and the Far East and give up the economic gains which can be made by this country in concert with action in the countries of the Pacific and turn these gains over to a communist world, whether it be managed or run from North Vietnam, Red China, or the Soviet Union? Oh, the isolationists will argue that times have changed. And let me say they have. They've changed to the effect that it should be obvious to all Americans that the historic importance placed by both Republican and Democratic administrations on the maintenance of our strength in the Pacific has become more proper and more needed today. Yes, many of us know that times have changed, but those liberals who suggest isolationism, the ones who talk so much about change, obvious have their eyes closed to the fact that times have changed, but they've changed in a way that we require this more today than ever. And there have been, as I've said, times in the past during which there may have been such reasons for an isolationist America, times when it was not only possible, but also proper to be isolationist. Let me say that it is not today either proper or possible. It is not proper because the problems of peace are inescapable. It is not possible because the technologies of war also are inescapable. The problems of peace are inescapable for a grim reason, which the new advocates of isolation deny, but which the realities of our time absolutely verify. That reason is the aggressive nature of communism. Now, during the earlier periods of isolation, it was possible to accurately say that the existence of totalitarian regimes elsewhere in the world didn't affect us and could be walled away by the thinking and the diplomacy of a fortress America. Now, Mr. Hitler pretty much ended that. Modern, industrially based or industrially aimed tyrannies do not exist in the old-fashioned and static self-containment of oppressing their own people, but leaving everybody else alone. Again, they too reflect the constant interrelationship of modern industrial nations. Purely agricultural or tribal societies perhaps could exist in perfect isolation, although the tendency of even some of the modern tribal states in Africa to pillage and invade is a disquieting indication that the virus of aggression is now epidemic. The communist tyrannies, however, are clearly involved in expansionistic dynamics. The Soviet Union, unlike every major non-communist nation on Earth, does not set itself the goal of freeing satellite or colonial peoples. Far from it. Its goal is at the very least to hang on to the conquered and captured territories. And also, even the most avid defender of a theory of mellowed communism would have to admit that the Soviet Union alone among major and modern nations spends a significant share of its time and treasure in encouraging the violent acquisition of territories abroad. Oh, the record of its support and continued support at that of violence-prone political movements around the world is too well known to require elaboration here or to be denied anywhere. And I'll remind you that the latest adventure in the Middle East is not an exception to Soviet policy, but simply an encouragement of it. And communist China follows the same path in the world, supporting everywhere it can those who would substitute violence for the peaceful process of politics. And stripped of all its many other admittedly controversial features, the war in Vietnam swings upon precisely that conflict. Whether violence is to be substituted for peaceful political process, and just to summarize the point fully, it was the Viet Cong, I repeat, the Viet Cong, not the Americans, not the South Vietnamese, not the French, who made the first substitution of violence for policy in the current conflict. And President Johnson, quoting Hanoi's own figures, has put it quite succinctly when he reminded the nation a week ago that more persons have been killed by communist terrorists while trying to vote in the South than have been killed in the North by aerial bombardment. But in terms of the isolationist argument, it should suffice to say that what is happening in Vietnam is nothing but a reflection in a terrible time and a terrible place of the fact that disturbance of the peace today is an ongoing result of the aggressive dynamics of communism. I'll remind you, there is no other operative cause of conflict in the world this moment. No other cause of trouble in this world. Communism. Conditions such as hunger, illiteracy, disease, internal political discontent, even strictly internal tyrannies, such as now dominate most of the newly emerged nations, do not cause, even if they make possible, the highly organized, well-supplied breaches of the peace which call the fate of the entire planet into question. And as proof, you need look no farther than Africa. In some of the new states there, unbelievably ferocious slaughters of native populations have been going on now for several years, slaughters with tolls far more vicious than those in Vietnam. And these, I'll remind you, have been the slaughters of intertribal warfare, fed by all the conditions which some are so fond of citing as the absolute causes of war, meaning poverty and ignorance. And yet, the peace of the world is not threatened by these bloodlettings, even though the conscience of the world might well be offended. I think, as a matter of fact, it must be offended. The reason is that these terrible things are not all directly comparable to the sort of communist thrusts which involve the direct interference of a foreign power in the internal affairs of another nation. Now, let me emphasize that point by saying the direct aggressive interference of a foreign power in the internal affairs of another nation. Communist disturbances of the peace always have had and still have that characteristic. They are not defensive. They are aggressive. At any rate, as applied to the isolationist argument, the presence of this overriding cause of unrest in the world shatters at the outset the very base on which a fortress America could be built. Unless you can imagine a fortress America that could exist at all, much less exist in freedom, while all other nations around it were spinning into the communist orbit, unless you can imagine that, you certainly cannot imagine a fortress America. And I hold that any man who can even think of such an America is a man who has lost not only all hope, but all good sense. Such a fortress America would obviously better be described as a garrison America. And would you want to live in a garrison America? Would the isolationists want to live in a garrison state? Have they thought their proposals through to the inescapable end? I see no sign of it. I see only the signs of reaction and panic and statements made in haste. And so long as the leaders of the two-headed communist world remain committed to violence as a tool of diplomacy, there is no possibility of hiding. There's no place to hide. There's no immunity. There's no withdrawal. Wherever that violence spreads, though it be thousands of miles from our shores, it is just inches from our future, unless we face up to it and then face it down. My other point, that the technologies of modern warfare make isolation impossible, involves facts of life which are so terrible that few have the stomach to face them. They can't be avoided, however, by shutting our eyes, our ears, or our minds. And as we stand here today, right this moment, it would be possible for the defense establishments of Great Britain or France or the Soviet Union or Red China or the United States to kill millions of persons anywhere on the earth. Now, the difficulties are just details. For the Red Chinese, those difficulties right now would involve nothing more, much more complex than a major job of smuggling. For the French, it would be a question of refueling. For the British, it might be the same. For us, or for the Soviet, it might be a question of simply the accuracy of maps, or the state of some maintenance schedule, or some other detail. Now, I know that this is a terribly oversimplified way to put it, and I know that we conservatives are constantly being accused of trying to make things simple, but I think simplicity in the long run is better than the complexities that we've been trying to live under for the last 35 years with not too much success. But modern weapons, for all their technical complexity, do pose starkly simple problems. One, for instance, is the avoidance of their use. Today, the major weapons of mass destruction, which are not limited, mind you, to nuclear weapons, but which include chemical and bacteriological weapons of equally horrible stature, are withheld from use not because there is a so-called balance of terror in the world, but because there is, quite to the contrary, an imbalance of terror. The destructive inventory of this country, developed during the Eisenhower administration, is so great that even today, there is good reason to believe it could overpower and make insanely costly any use of such weapons by anyone else anywhere in the world. And that is the situation this noon. And remember, it's a situation based upon decisions made and research begun over a full decade ago. And there's every responsible reason to believe that, given the absolute refusal of this administration to permit the development of new major strategic weapon systems, this imbalance will end in the decade of the 1970s, and that the balance itself will shift to an imbalance on the side of communism thereafter. And this shift, incidentally, could take place regardless of a change in administration due to the lopsided lead times demanded for such development. And it's quite possible that only a major crash program could avert the shift, and there are distinct limits to how long even such a program can be delayed before it is totally frustrated by the inexorable ticking of the technological clock. The communist states, remember, have not been standing still along with us. Research expenditures in both the Soviet Union and in Red China have been directed toward upsetting, not maintaining, a balance of terror. Thus, technology, too, is a pin to burst any bubble of isolationist illusion. Now, how odd it must be for the ghosts of Republicans past to hear the talk which would today tell them that it is Republicans who are leading the fight for a fully involved, fully committed, and fully international American viewpoint, while it is the Democrats who lead the chorus for isolationism, with one or two minor exceptions. Many of us know that they have changed, and we have based our political lives upon that knowledge all along. In fact, some of us have even staked and perhaps lost our political lives because of it. Let me remind you, as an example, that the several votes cast against the nuclear test ban treaty in the Senate of the United States were based solidly upon the belief that this nation could not afford to halt its research efforts so long as those who menaced the peace had advanced beyond us, as, for instance, the Soviet had in the area of high-yield detonations and the understanding of electromagnetic pulse effects. And those who speak for the isolationist view, of course, feel that there is no need or place for American strength because they feel there is no need or place for American presence anywhere in the world beyond the borders of our own nation. And they carry that belief as they would a magical umbrella. They carry it precisely like the magical umbrella that Neville Chamberlain carried to and from Munich. And they carry it under just such clouds as hovered over the world then. Millions died because of the folly of men who wanted to play it safe by playing it blind. Today, another change is in numbers. Many millions more have their lives and their freedoms on the line. And the forces that would use violence in the world are stronger, more experienced, and more entrenched. Ladies and gentlemen, there is only the isolation of the graveyard for those who will not live in and be a part of the world today. After all, it's all we have. We can't stop this old world and get off. And let it never be America against the world. Let it always be America with the world. It is ours, and it's the world's very best hope. I thank you.
Thank you, Senator. From the looks of the many questions in front of our president, I don't think I've ever seen so many. Apparently, there were a few things you didn't touch on. Thank you for the talk, Senator. We appreciate it very much. We'll now turn the meeting over to our master catalyst who has weeded out these questions for you, our president, Mr. Travers.
Thank you, Jack. Senator, hold on back. Let's change this angle just a little bit for us.
Jack, you're right. We have more questions than I've ever had to field before. They fall primarily in these categories, and I have tried to select out the key questions in each of them. Vietnam, politics 1968, fiscal policy, the French war debt, and change in our defense policies. Senator, the first question. In the 1964 presidential campaign, the Democrats warned the people that if they elected you, you would get us into a war in Vietnam. What are they saying about you now?
Well, I can't repeat that. No, a simple thing. The president finally realized in his heart he knows I was right. And... You just said,
politics 1968. It is alleged that the Republicans could easily beat LBJ in 1968 if only they didn't have to put up a candidate. Do you agree?
I could make quite a comment on that. But first of all, I'll tell you, I don't think it's going to be easy for the Republicans to beat President Johnson. I think the war is going to be over. I think the war is going much better than we realize. My guess is about 11 months, within 11 months it'll be over. I have friends much closer to the picture than I am who want to lay a little money on, say, July, but I haven't succumbed yet. He is the incumbent. And I've run against an incumbent. There's quite a bit of muscle on that side. A lot of jobs, a lot of money, a lot of influence. And any Republican who thinks that Johnson will be beaten automatically is just, frankly, out of their heads. Now, I don't think that the Republican Party is going to fall into the disastrous trap it fell into in 64, where their candidate went forth to do battle with his armor already stripped off of him and most of the blood gone from the body. I think we'll find primary campaigns, and I hope someday we get smart in this country and stop these crazy multitudinous primaries and have one primary for both parties and then have a general and have them close together. I really think we've learned our lesson. We should. We Republicans take a long time to learn that we can't fight each other and win, but I do think that that we will put together a good team in 68, and that those who try and are not successful will not keep on throwing knives after the convention. I think they'll get in and work, and it may be hard to beat him, but I've never been in an easy campaign yet. Someday I'm going to find one.
Senator, that was a general question, but the unabashed directness of our questioners comes out in this, which I labeled today's $64 question, divided into two parts. Politics, 1968. A, who is your choice for the Republican nomination? B, which of the Republican candidates could most easily beat LBJ?
Well, I'll answer the second one first. I think I've already answered. No Republican candidate will have an easy time of it. It's no secret that I've been openly backing Dick Nixon for the presidential spot. And as long as you ask the question, I'll answer it. I'm hearing more and more talk amongst party leaders in the different states that I get into of a Nixon-Reagan combination. And while your governor, of course, is one of my closest friends, keeps denying
that he would want this or either the other spot. He has said publicly and said to me and to the press that he probably would not turn his party down. So I just report that out across America, particularly in the West, this combination is looking more and more. It's sort of a selfish thing. We'd have a fellow relatively young, and I say that advisedly, who could be 8 years as an understudy and then step in for 8 years of the top man. We'd have 16 years of Republican control of the country, and I can't think of anything better.
Again, politics, 1968. Does George Wallace offer a threat to the Republican Party?
Yes, he does. And I've said publicly in his own state that he would guarantee the reelection of President Johnson. How would this happen? Well, take a state like mine, which is a Democratic state, although in their wisdom they've been voting Republican for some time. I only won that state by 1%. Now, Wallace is going to take votes out of every state in the Union. And let's say he takes 2% of Arizona's votes and it's another close election. Johnson would be the winner, not the Republican. Now, I'm very hopeful that this man who he makes sense as he talks to people, he answers the questions that are on people's minds, who see in their hearts no real choice for a constitutional government under either party. Now, I disagree with that, but it's their right to feel that way. I think that if Governor Wallace saw that the Republicans were going to put up a team like Nixon and Reagan, that he'd probably back away and not run. Because it's only under the two-party system that we can make our kind of government survive. If you can be a dissident about the two parties and form a third, then you'll have dissidents in the third, and you'll have a fourth and a fifth, and we'll become like France did with 19 parties. And I don't think any American would ever want to see that happen, and I think one of the first ones would argue against it would be Governor Wallace himself. So I said facetiously in the East that if I were President Johnson, I'd finance Governor Wallace's campaign, and then I'd build a monument to him down on the Pedernales and called it Wallace on the Pedernales or something like that.
Senator Barry Goldwater, great American citizen. We have time for but just one more question. Before I ask that last question, on behalf of the more than 12,000 members of the Commonwealth Club of California, and there are many wonderful ladies, and you can see a great many of them here today in another overflow crowd at the Sheraton Palace Hotel for our traditional Friday luncheon meetings, now in their 60th year, Senator, I want to thank you very much for coming here to be with us today to talk to us about the United States and the world today. The warmth of the greeting of our members is a testimony to the success of your remarks. At the conclusion of the answer to this last question, our meeting will stand adjourned. The question is this. I am one of thousands of lifelong registered Republicans who made a grave error in November 1964 and must continue to observe my folly until November 1968. What hope is there for such as I come Election Day?
Oh, I think everybody's entitled to a mistake. I probably had more than my share of them, but I know we had about 6 to 8 million Republicans who didn't vote for the ticket in 1964. I feel most of them didn't vote for Johnson. They just didn't vote. And to be perfectly honest with you, if I had not known Goldwater and had to depend upon the press, TV, and radio, both domestic and foreign, for a picture of this fellow, I would have voted violently against him. This is America's right, Americans' right to vote as they please. As I say, if we conduct a primary campaign in an intelligent, gentlemanly way this year or next year, there should be no reason for 6 to 8 million Republican Americans leaving their party because they honestly felt, and I mean honestly felt, that the candidate was going to drop a bomb, or the candidate was going to get us into war, was going to cause inflation, and all these terrible things which could never happen under Johnson.
Surprisingly, many questions about de Gaulle, France, and the French war debt. The first, France owes us $6 billion and yet turns in our paper money and demands gold. Why do we let de Gaulle get away with it?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I wished I had had a legal opinion on it before I got here today, but I haven't. But according to my memory, I can't recall that our country has ever excused France officially from paying its debt. We did excuse Germany when Germany found herself unable to pay her debts. I'm in perfect accord with the thought behind this question that as de Gaulle presents his little billy-doos for our goal, that we just present him a refigured statement on how much he owes us. That was very easy.